It was an email that I could have written word for word from memory. It was a mom who sent me an email detailing to me how her child had walked away from the faith. And as I read the opening lines, I realized very quickly it was just like many, many others that I had also read. It started something like this. When my son was little, he was very active in the church. We were there every Sunday, every Wednesday night. He was an active part of the youth group, even went on mission trips. As some of you in this room, you could probably finish this email. Because she went on to talk about how he went off to college. And while at college, he started questioning everything. Questioning not only the church, but questioning a belief in God. In fact, within a year and a half, her son had decided he no longer believed in God. And she was asking me, is there anything that I could send, anything that I had that I could give to him to bring him back? Now, let me make sure you understand. Anytime somebody writes to me, calls me, I will do everything within my power to help their soul. But folks, once they hit that point, oftentimes it's too late. Oftentimes they have already closed the door on the idea of a God, and they don't want to reopen that door. And so here's something for me to go ahead and start out telling parents and grandparents. Make sure your child doesn't close that door. If you've got a child right now who is questioning their faith, questioning the existence of God, do everything you can, get them all the resources you can before they finally close the door on the Creator. I sent them some books, sent some material, and sure enough, this was one of those situations where the son had already decided in his mind that intelligent people don't believe in God. In fact, one of the phrases that I've heard many, many times is religion is a crutch for the weak-minded. Now, let me make sure you understand, that young person did not come up with that idea themselves. That young person was indoctrinated with that at a college or university. And so that young person went off to school and heard from some professor, all smart, intelligent people believe evolution. It's Adolf Hitler who once made the comment, if you tell a big enough lie and tell it frequently enough, it will be believed. And folks, let me make sure you understand, in our culture today, we got a lot of people who have bought in to the idea of evolution. I left off last night, for those of you who were here, with this slide right here. And we talked about the fact that according to the Bible, things aren't really all that old. Now, the obvious follow-up question is, okay, where's the evidence for that? You know, I've got friends, I've got coworkers. How do I prove to them that things aren't really old? Let's start with numbers, because numbers don't lie. They're incapable of lying. So let's say we use the population, the human population. Right now we know the human population is doubling every 35 years. That's with diseases, wars, famines. Every 35 years the population doubles. Now, knowing that, let's take two people. We'll call them Adam and Eve. And let's start 1 million years ago. Now, please understand that's very, very conservative because most evolutionists would say man started about 3 million years ago. But we're going to be conservative. We'll say 1 million years ago, average generation time, again, being conservative, about every 42 years, only 2.4 children on average per family. Now, that's really conservative because there's some of you in this room, you can remember your grandparents having very large families, right? I've got four. Today, I'm considered to have a huge family. I'm looking back at people who used to have seven, eight, nine siblings. My wife, her father had eight. Now, that's a big family. Because when you go car shopping for that many people, all of a sudden, there's a whole lot you can't purchase to get 10 people into an automobile. 2.4 children per family. You do the math, here's what you find out. If we started a million years ago, generation time of 42 years, 2.4 kids per family, the human population on this earth should be 10 to the 5,000th power. That's a 10 with 5,000 zeros after it. Now, I could only get 1,000 on this screen. That means you got four more screens of zeros. That's what the population should be if evolution is true. Now, why is that a big deal to me? That's a pretty big deal to me because all of the universe that the Hubble telescope has looked at would only hold about 10 to the 100th people. And yet I just said 10 to the 5,000th. That means for every area the size of a quarter, you'd have 500 people. And you hope they wear deodorant, right? Now, let's flip it a minute. How about we start off with two people? Again, we'll call them Adam and Eve. And this time, using the same generation time, same 2.4 children per family, but we start just about 6,000 years ago. You do the math, you realize we should be sitting at 8.34 billion. Now, you look at me and you say, hey, that's a whole lot closer. And I would say, yeah, but we're still too high, right? Because we know the human population just clicked over 7 billion. But here's what I would do. I would look at each one of you, smile, and simply say, you're right. But what happened about 4,000 years ago that knocked us back to just 8? The flood. You see, the numbers don't lie. Man-made theories might, but the numbers don't. Let me point out to you in this room, if you are a skeptic tonight, I welcome you trying to show me, doing the math, how you can come up with a population of 7 billion if things are millions or billions of years old. I've asked lots and lots of atheists. In fact, I've offered money to atheists if they could show me how do you do it. And guess what? They can't. So the first way is we use numbers. But not just numbers. What about attacking the very heart of their theory? The heart of their theory is that things are billions and billions of years old. And with enough time, surely we can get all this complexity, all this stuff. Let me ask you, is that true? If you add time to something, does it make things more complex or more simple? Simple. Everything's wearing out. It's running down, right? Second law of thermodynamics says, you leave your car in your front yard for 50 years, guess what it's going to look like? It's going to have weeds coming up through it. So adding time doesn't make things more complex. It should make things more simple. And yet, here's their statement. In a closed universe, a Big Bang may occur once every 80 to 100 billion years. Where's the science in that? I mean, you might as well say once upon a time, right? Because nobody in this room has lived 80 to 100 billion years. And yet, that's precisely what they're trying to communicate. Obvious question. Where's God if we can't see him? That's their crutch. That's their fallback. That's what they like to beat Christians over the head with. Oh, you believe in God? Well, have you seen him lately? Let's do this. Let's see what we can use to prove the existence of a creator versus a Big Bang explosion. Let's say we go on a little hike together, right? While we're on that hike, we come across some of the beauty of God's creation. Right now, outside these walls, you are confronted with all kinds of trees, flowers, literally the beauty of spring, right? But let's say that while we're there, we see this guy right here. Little frog. Now, you guys see a little frog. I see a great teaching opportunity. So when I see something like that, I think, okay, how about we take that, we bring it back into this auditorium, and we put it into a blender. And I invite one of you to come up and to press the on button. What would we get? Well, obviously, we'd get frog juice, right? Now, follow me for just a moment. If I took that solution, I poured it into a container, and I handed that to you, could we say that there is everything in that solution to make a frog? Like, do you have all the DNA, all the proteins necessary? Absolutely, right? So how long would you have to shake that solution to make a frog? Or how much electricity would you have to zap it with in order to get a frog? I think everybody in this room recognizes the truth. You would never have a frog, right? All you would ever have is frog juice. Now, think about this for just a moment. They're trying to tell you that all life evolved up out of some primordial soup. Folks, if you can't get a frog with me giving you all the parts necessary, how in the world are you going to get something hopping up out of that? By the way, one frog is not enough. I was on a college campus in South Dakota a couple of years back and had a guy get really, really upset with me because I'd kind of turned his whole worldview upside down. I finished my seminar. He comes bolting down the aisle, shaking his finger at me. He said, it could have happened. I said, time out. What could have happened? He said, fish. Fish could have evolved out of the water onto the land. And I thought to myself, bless his heart, he's drank all the Kool-Aid. I said, do you have a second or two that you and I could just sit down right here and talk one-on-one? He kind of huffed and puffed. He said, yeah. I said, all right. So we sat down. I looked at him, and I said, I want you to forget everything you've ever read in a textbook and just use your brain. What would it take to make a fish become a land dweller? And so I started rolling. I said, that fish, very quickly, his eyes are going to dry out because he's no longer in an aqueous environment. He's going to have lacrimal gland, tear ducts, right? So he's got to evolve tear ducts within the first few minutes. Not just that, the scales would dry out. So he's going to have to get rid of the scales quickly, get some kind of a permeable membrane, sweat glands. Talk to him about the digestive system. He's now able to eat different things. His immune system's got to change. After like 5 minutes, the guy starts joining me, right? He's adding things to the list. After about 7 minutes, I stopped him. I said, you realize we still haven't named the biggest hurdle that fish has? His eyes got about this big. He said, what is it? I said, we still haven't named the biggest problem. He said, what was the problem? I said, that fish has got to convince his girlfriend to go with him. Because one fish is not enough, correct? You got to have a male and a female. And yet, they present it to our students like, oh, yes, yeah, some fish decided he wanted to wake up one day, walk out onto the land. If you really stop and think about what they're teaching our kids, it's ludicrous. And here's why. Supposedly, all animals started in the water, right? Then they decided, hey, we got to jump out onto the land. Maybe there's better food out there. You know, there's a Sonic, whatever. So they come out on land, but for some reason, some of those cows decided, you know what? I really like the water. So they evolved a blowhole, and all of a sudden now we get mammals and dolphins. Okay, think about that one for just a moment. We go from fish to mammals and back in the water? Yeah, that's their story. Folks, I'm still holding the frog juice waiting for somebody just to make a frog. And yet they can't do it. If that's the case, how in the world did a big bang bring everything into existence? I mean, what pulled the trigger on that bang? I had a youth minister ask me the question you see on the screen. Could God have used a big bang to get us to where we are today? Now, before I answer that question, the first thing I want to point out is, you ever notice how the textbooks never ever explain where the original matter for that bang came from? They start literally mid-bang, so to speak. In fact, you open some of those textbooks, here's what we find. This idea that there was this little dot in space, that dot decided to blow up, and billions of years later, here we are. This is the April 2002 issue of Discover Magazine. You'll notice it says, where did we come from? This got a little red dot right in the center of the screen. According to them, that was the size of the universe at 10 to the minus 34 seconds before the Big Bang. In fact, I'm going to blow up the little subheading that you see at the bottom down there. It says, the universe burst into something from absolutely nothing. Zero, nada. As it got bigger, it became filled with even more stuff that came from absolutely nowhere. Now, let me ask you, does that sound scientific to anybody in this room? Our kids are clinging to evolution because they think it's the intellectually elite argument. All smart people believe in it. Look at what they really are believing in right here. The universe burst into something from absolutely nothing. And then, as it got bigger, it became filled with even more stuff that came from absolutely nowhere. So, here's what I want you to do. Go home, grab a box, shake it out. Make sure it's empty, okay? Got this big box. I want you to find the biggest roll of duct tape you can find. Tape up that box completely. Stick it in your closet for 50 years. After 50 years, here's what I want you to do. Hand it off to your children, your grandchildren, and say, do not open this until 50 more years. So they go home, they stick it in their closet. 50 years later, so we're now 100 years past the original time. 100 years later, somebody takes a box knife, they cut open that box. What do you think's going to be in it? Don't say nothing. Because surely evolution is true, and there's going to be like ferns and plants and animals, rhinoceros come running out. No, everybody in this room knows. Nothing produces what? Nothing. It's actually a scientific fact. And yet, they're trying to teach us this idea that nothing gave rise to everything. So, we think about it. We say, all right, how's that possible? They say, ask Alan Guth. His theory of inflation helps explain everything. All right, let's ask this guy, Alan Guth. He gave an interview in Omni Magazine several years ago. They asked him the question. They said, how big was this very early pre-inflation universe? How big was the pre-Big Bang universe? Look at his answer. He says, amazingly small, about 10 to the minus 24 centimeters across. He says, smaller than a proton. Also amazing, it would have contained only about 25 pounds of matter. All right, what's my next question? Where'd your 25 pounds come from? Folks, he didn't explain the existence of the universe. All he did was shrink it down to 25 pounds, blow some smoke in your face, and hope you didn't see through it. By the way, is it logical for everybody in this room? Is it logical that everything in this room came from 25 pounds? Folks, there's some of us in this room, we could lose 25 pounds. I mean, just saying. Is it logical to conclude that everything in McEwen, Tennessee came from 25 pounds? Every piece of asphalt, every tree, every rock. By the way, isn't it interesting? We know the weight of water, about 9 pounds a gallon. Is it logical to conclude that every drop of water on this planet came from 25 pounds? Because that's what they're claiming. Not just this planet, they're saying every planet in all the universe. So, do I have a problem scientifically with their theory? Oh, yeah. Their idea is about 3.4 seconds, everything radiated out into an ordered universe. Big problem. Number one, you've created matter from nothing. Number two, you've gone from a chaotic explosion to an ordered universe. Does that make sense to anybody? I mean, you think about driving down I-40. I know this will surprise you, but occasionally they do construction on I-40. I know that surprises you. So imagine them blowing up rocks on the side of the road. And after that explosion, you get this nice, neat, ordered. Are they ever nice, neat, and ordered when they come from an explosion? Or do the rocks just look like big chunks? I've never seen a spherical rock come from an explosion, have you? And yet, that's what they're claiming. Not just that, we ask the question, how do you get around violating the idea that you just create matter from nothing and that you get this ordered universe? Paul Davies, who, by the way, he is an evolutionist, he is one of those who thinks that we are intellectually inferior. He says this: the Big Bang represents the instantaneous suspension of physical laws, the sudden abrupt flash of lawlessness that allowed something to come out of nothing. He said it represents a true miracle. Which I would ask him, all right, why is that more scientific than saying, in the beginning, God did it? You see, folks, think about it for just a moment. Let's say we did have a little ball out in space. What caused that ball to change? What caused it to either implode on itself or what pulled the trigger so that it went boom? Because if that's all that existed, there's no energy acting on it. And yet, according to them, oh yeah, makes perfect sense. Of course, they have to rely on a miracle, but to them, that makes perfect sense. As a scientist, I look at the Big Bang and I realize we got some problems. Let me share a couple of them with you. Number one, there's not an even distribution of matter. So if you got a central explosion, right? Everything radiates out from that. You should have a pretty even distribution of the carbon particles, the nitrogen particles. We know today, sun is made up of 98% hydrogen and helium. And yet you look at the first few planets, and here's what we discover. Less than 1% of the first four planets is made up of hydrogen and helium. Does that sound like an even distribution to anybody? Or does that sound more like maybe there was a creator who had a plan? Not just that, we know that Jupiter is way too hot. It's actually cooling off at a rate of twice the amount of heat it's receiving from the sun, telling us Jupiter ain't been around for billions of years because it should have long cooled off by now. It should have long given off the heat. Now, anytime something is hot, here's what it does. It exchanges heat with whatever environment it's in. Obvious example, if your wife goes home and bakes your favorite cookies, right? About the time she pulls those cookies out of the oven, now I'm not a chocolate chip fan. My wife, she thinks chocolate chips came from God directly, okay? I don't. I'm more of like an oatmeal raisin snickerdoodle kind of. But let's just say you got your warm, gooey chocolate chip cookies. She puts them out on the oven. And about the time you reach one for one, she smacks your hand. She says, "Nuh-uh, they're not cooled enough yet." And so there you are. You got saliva going down your face. You're just waiting. You say, "How long?" She says, "About 18 billion years." Everybody in this room recognizes that's crazy. It should have long cooled off by now. And yet we know today some of the moons that are rotating around Jupiter, they've still got molten liquid centers. Bob Berman, who is an astronomer, he's a scientist. He wrote in the journal Astronomy several years ago that a warning should be placed before every article that has to do with the Big Bang. Look at what this warning says. Warning, the following contains contemporary cosmology. Reading it can produce disorientation and confusion. Nobody knows what's going on, and nothing you read here is likely to be true. Now, that's one astronomer writing to his fellow astronomers. How do we present it in textbooks? As fact. Let's get back to that question for just a minute. Could God have used a Big Bang to get us to where we are today? If you got a Bible tonight, open it up. Genesis chapter 1. Let's take a look at the first two verses. Genesis chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void. Darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved over the surface of the waters. If I were to ask you, how does Moses describe the earth on that very first day? Well, ask yourself this question. What was the Spirit of God moving over? Waters. You know, we don't think about this way, but on that first day, God hadn't brought forth land. This was a water-covered ball. Now, do we know, scientifically speaking, do we know the boiling temperature of water? I should see heads doing this. It's either 100 degrees or 212, depending on whether you use Fahrenheit or Celsius, right? At that temperature, what happens to water? It goes into steam. Folks, that Big Bang took place at a temperature allegedly you and I can't even fathom. They would say it was in the millions of degrees. So how do you go from a million-degree explosion to having a water-covered heavenly body on the same day? Fact is, you can't. Now, add to that little problem, according to the Bible, what day were all flowering plants, fruit-yielding plants, seed-bearing plants, what day were they created? According to the text, day three. And yet, what day did the sun, the moon, the stars come into the picture? Day four, if I can get my clicker to work. It's not just your clicker, by the way, Hobie. It's all clickers. According to the Bible, sun, moon, stars came into picture on day four. So follow me for just a minute. Here's what that means. That means there were plants on this earth before there was ever any heavenly bodies out there. Now, if you can fit that into a Big Bang, I would love to hear about it. And let me just point out something to you that really kind of gets up under my skin. We got a lot of Christian colleges today who aren't teaching the truth. I'm just going to go ahead and say it. And what I mean by that is we got Christian colleges who are saying, Genesis, you know, it really isn't meant to be literal. It's a figurative book, or as one college in Arkansas says, it's a poetic book. that there really wasn't a creation account. It really wasn't a global flood. Let me tell you something, guys. You take Genesis chapter 1, 2, and 3 out of the Bible and just call it a poem or figurative language, you've just messed with the whole scheme of redemption of man. Because last time I checked, God's original plan for everybody in this room, and sometimes we forget this, his original plan was that we would be with him in a garden. We didn't have to think about heaven, didn't have to think about dying, didn't have to think about cancer, disease, nothing. We were going to be with him in a garden, and sin messed it up. Sin separated us from God. From Genesis 3 all the way to the end of the book of Revelation, he's trying to tell us how to get back into that covenant relationship with God, ultimately through Jesus Christ. You take Genesis chapters 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 out of the picture, you just screwed up the whole scheme of redemption. And yet today, we've got colleges that are saying, ah, don't worry about it, it's not important, which, by the way, again, if you can't trust the first verse, why would you trust anything to follow, right? So, do I think that God used the Big Bang to get us to where we are today? Nope. I have heard some Christians say, well, you know, Brad, he said bang and it happened. Okay, I'll give you that, you know, maybe. But at the end of the day, it wasn't Big Bang as in a whole bunch of stuff that came out of a central explosion that finally cooled down, and lo and behold, now we've got an earth. By the way, you ever notice the Bible says we got water first, then land came into the picture, right? It's not what evolution says. Evolution says you got this cosmic explosion, they cooled down, we got land, we got rocks, and finally we get water. Okay, where'd the water come from? You ever thought about that? Three-fourths of this earth is covered in water. Where'd it come from? I had a professor one time heckling me. He was sitting right over here. He looked at me and goes, came from the water cycle. He's talking down to me like I was about that big. I looked at him. I said, good try, Sparky. But last time I checked, water cycle, in order to have one, you've got to have what? Water. They don't even know how. In fact, 2009, they finally decided, well, maybe all the water on this planet was delivered by meteorites. Okay, let me get this straight. You're telling me meteorites are in the water delivery business? We've never seen that, by the way, scientifically. Second problem, what happens to a meteorite when it hits our Earth's atmosphere? Burns up. What would happen to the water? Folks, they can't even describe to you how we got water. And yet, they are so quick to say, was your ancestor a sea sponge? This is your ancestor. Okay, maybe their ancestor. It's not mine. But you remember last night I mentioned they use certain words, certain phrases to evolutionize your mind. One of those is the geologic column. Carboniferous period, the Triassic period, the Jurassic, each one having certain dates. I had a guy one time, he and I were talking, he mentioned it. I said, so were you taught all the different layers? He literally named it top to bottom. I said, did they teach you how the geologic column was put together? He looked at me, blinked, he said, no, I don't remember that. I said, I didn't think so. Because you see, the geologic column was actually built in the 1800s, and it was based almost solely on assumptions. Because in the 1800s, we had no idea how quick you could make a canyon or how long it took to form all those stratal layers. 39 years ago, all of our assumptions were blown away, basically in a single day. 39 years ago, Mount St. Helens erupted. And with that single event, we learned more about geology than we had learned the previous 100 years. Now, those of you sitting out there going, was it really 39? Yes, you are that old, okay? May the 18th, 1980 was the eruption date. Here you see a picture. It's the most studied volcano in the U.S. They had all kinds of sensors on it. Here's one of the cool trivia for you right here. The week before it erupted, the mountain itself was growing in girth 35 feet a day. That's a lot. I tell young people, it's like a big zit just waiting to explode, right? Now, picture this for just a minute. Let's say I take an old-fashioned bottle of Coke and I shake it up, toss it to you. You got a bottle opener. What would happen if you just opened a little bit? It'd come flooding out, right? All the pressure. Well, lo and behold, here's what happened. The north slope of Mount St. Helens slid down, and it was just like that cap coming off of the Coke. All the steam, all of the pressure, all of the heat that was underneath that had been building up finally was released, and in just a matter of seconds, that mountain was reduced to rubble. My oldest son and I, we were there on the 30th anniversary of the Mount St. Helens eruption. And before I let you guys sugar up with cookies, we're going to talk about five things that you can learn using the acronym SUPER, S-U-P-E-R. And for all the folks in this room that go to Jackson Temple, that's your preacher right there in the ball cap. Just want to point that out to you. S-U-P-E-R, super. First one is for that S, the striatal layers. You know, you go down I-40, you see the layers in the rocks. They tell us that each one of those layers was put down over millions of years. I mean, everybody in here has probably seen images like that, right? That rock bluff's about 120 feet tall. And the reason that I know that, Will and I, we were standing right at the base of it as we filmed part of a little documentary. And as you look, you see all the different layers. Evolutionists call the top layer that you're looking at right there, they say that's sedimentary rock. They say it's over 100 million years old. Now, here's the problem with that. Everything you're looking at was put down in just a matter of days in 1980. Here's what that means. That means if you were born before 1980 in this room, I can look at you and tell you, you're old as a rock. And mean it. It's funny to me. People are always like, Brad, Earth can't be that old, man. It can't be that young because it looks so old. You know, the rocks, look at them. And I'm thinking, what does a young rock look like? It's not like they come out with diapers, right? By the way, we actually have video proof. If you look on the screen, the very first yellow line at the bottom, that was all, everything underneath there was laid down in the original eruption, May the 18th, 1980. There was a secondary eruption, June the 20th, that same year, that put all the layers in between the two yellow lines. There was another secondary eruption, March the 19th, 1982, that put everything on top. Here's my point. Everything you're looking at in that picture was put down in just 2 years. Not 2,000, not 2 million, just two. So do we know today that catastrophes, volcanoes could cause some of these things to happen really quick? Oh, yeah. By the way, anybody in here think that maybe during a global flood there might have been some volcanoes going off? Oh, yeah. Read the text. Genesis chapter 7, verse 11 talks about the windows of heaven opening and the fountains of the great deep breaking up. Okay, fountains of the great deep breaking up. Think about this for just a minute. When you go deeper in the earth's crust, do you get hotter or colder? That's where the mantle is, lava is, right? It's hotter. If you're breaking up stuff down there, do you think there could be some volcanoes? Oh, yeah. So the S is for those striatal layers. The U is for upright logs. On the north sector of Mount St. Helens, there's a lake called Spirit Lake. When the volcano erupted, here's what happened. All the trees in that closest ridge area, immediately they lost all their branches, and the trunks were flushed into Spirit Lake. We had the opportunity to take a look at it. Big, massive log mat, still floating, by the way, 30 years later. A friend of mine by the name of Dr. Steve Austin has done extensive work in Spirit Lake. If you look at the very bottom of the screen, you'll notice there's a guy in scuba gear and one of his colleagues with him. That's Steve. And he told me, he said, Brad, here's what's happening. The logs, they're floating for decades before finally the heavy root end will sink down. And he said those trees will actually bob up and down in the water, standing straight up and down. Will and I saw several doing just that while we were there. He said, only after several more years will they finally sink standing straight up and down. He actually shared with me some video of fish swimming between trees underwater. Now, this is what we know happened from a catastrophe in Mount St. Helens. You got secondary eruptions, more ash and lava start to settle down around them, and they're buried quite literally standing straight up. And it's also exactly what we see in the fossil record. On the screen behind me, you see a picture that was taken in France. There are three men at the base of that little cliff, but what I want you to focus on, there's five trees that have been fossilized going through several different layers. Now think about this for just a minute. This guy right here, if you look carefully, he starts out in the Carboniferous layer. According to evolutionists, that's 250 million years ago, and he grows all the way up through the Jurassic, the Triassic. Okay, if you're a tree, are you going to stick around for 150 million years? Or would you decay and rot? And yet, here's the beautiful thing. We've got these examples literally all the way around the globe. My family and I, we were in Nova Scotia not too long ago. A place called the Fundy Bay, where water goes in and out of this bay quicker than just about anywhere else on the planet. While we were there, we had the opportunity to look, and lo and behold, there's more of these fossils that are going through several different layers. Trees, quite literally, that pass through sedimentary rock. This one's down in Alabama. This one's in Cookeville. Again, how do you explain a fossil, be it a tree? In one case in California, there's actually a whale that's been fossilized through several different layers. How do you get fossils that go through several different layers if each one of those layers is put down over millions of years? Unless the whole geologic column has problems, which it does. So the U is for upright logs. The P is for peat formation. While we were there, we had the opportunity to take a helicopter ride, do some aerial photography, go down into the volcano, looking around. You can ask Will how the other cameraman liked it when they took the door off the helicopter. Every time we would turn the helicopter a certain way, we'd hear him say, okay, that's good, that's good. He's afraid he's going to fall out. We're up there looking around, and one of the things that you could make out very easily, in fact, we took this picture That's the log mat that I was just talking about. And if you fly out over it or you walk out to it, one of the things that you'll notice, there's not a stitch of bark on any of those trees. Because they've been bumping together for 30 years. All of the bark is in the bottom of the lake. In fact, my buddy Steve Austin told me, he said, "Brad, we have found bark that's turned into peat 8, 9, 12 feet deep in the bottom of this lake." He said, "We got peat beds that are over 10 feet deep." Now, you look at that and you say, "So what? Who cares?" Peat is a precursor for making coal. They're actually making coal in the bottom of that lake during our lifetime. Now think about it. In order to make coal, you got to have some kind of a substance like peat. They got it from the bark. You also have to have weight, lots of pressure, which water's pretty heavy. You also got to have a lot of heat. Well, let's see, a volcano would do that. And so they're actually making coal during our lifetime. Why is that a big deal? That's a big deal because, folks, listen to me. They're teaching our kids that all the coal in America was laid down 250 million years ago. Scientifically, that's rubbish. We can do it today in a laboratory a whole lot quicker than that. So the P is for peat formation. The E is for rapidly eroding canyons. Now, if I didn't tell you anything at all about that picture other than those canyons are about 600 feet deep, you might think that that little water stream right there, that carved out that canyon, right? Because that's what they always tell us. And yet, what you're looking at was carved out in about 2 days. When you go to Mount St. Helens, when you enter the blast zone, one of the very first things you'll notice is that volcano did not erupt straight up. It also came out. In fact, if you look right here, you're basically missing a whole side of the mountain. Remember I told you, it's growing 35 feet a day. All of the snow and the ice on this sector right here slid down into this valley the week before it erupted. So it's growing, it's growing, it's growing. The snow and ice slide down into the valley, and then it goes boom. What do you think happens to snow and ice when it comes in contact with lava? It turned into steam just like that. And steam's got to go somewhere. And so it actually blew steam vents 600 feet deep in 2 days. Not 2 million, not 2,000, not even 2 years. 2 days. Now compare that to a textbook that's teaching our kids over millions of years the Colorado River's carved out the Grand Canyon from solid rock. I'm going to do this just for fun. Let me see a show of hands. How many of you in here remember being taught that the Colorado River carved out the Grand Canyon? All right, good. Most of yeah, we're going to learn something tonight. Here's what we know for sure. We know it's a fact that the Grand Canyon exists, right? It's not a hallucination. Some of you have had the pleasure of seeing it. Two different interpretations. You got evolutionists who say, hey, it was formed slowly with a little bit of water over a long period of time. Then you got evolutionists that say, wait a second, time out. Or creationists that say, time out. We got a living laboratory called Mount St. Helens that showed us you can do this really quickly. Whole lot of water over a short amount of time. Now, the problem is evolutionists are continually trying to erase the line between what is truth and what's their interpretation. And so the textbooks are filled with ideas like this. Millions of years, Colorado River cut that canyon. Okay, if you don't remember anything else tonight, remember this. That river didn't carve out that canyon. And here's why I know that. If you go there today, right over here, right beside the Navajo Indian Reservation, is where the river enters the canyon. It enters at a level, sea level of 2,800 feet in elevation. Okay? If you don't believe me, you can take a GPS, you can go measure for yourself, but right over here, you're going to be at an elevation about 2,800 feet. Now, the south rim, the part that everybody loves to go look at, you see the handiwork of God, is sitting right over here at an elevation of 6,900 feet. In order for that river to have carved that canyon, that means water would have to flow uphill over 4,000 feet in elevation. Now, I grant you, I'm not a hydrologist, but I do know water seeks the lowest level, right? That river didn't carve out that canyon. Now, I could think of a couple other ways. Maybe you could have like a mid-continental lake where you breach a dam and all of a sudden you got lots of water going very quickly. Would that do it? Yeah, that would do it. Or how about this? Would a global flood do it? Yeah, that would do it. By the way, if the river carved the canyon, where's all the stuff that used to be in the canyon? Because I'll tell you where it's not. It's nowhere around there. So the E is for rapidly eroding canyons. The R is for rapid recovery. I took this picture our very first day, about first 10 minutes into the blast zone. And as you can tell from the picture, stuff is back. Now, those of you who were living when Mount St. Helens erupted, you may remember scientists first came out and they said it'll be 60,000 years before stuff comes back the way it was. Then they self-corrected. They said 30,000. All right, that's 30 years to the day. Problem is they were using evolutionary timelines. It's interesting, the elk, they were some of the first creatures to actually come back. If you know anything at all about elk, they have very, very tough hooves. They would walk out across the pyroclastic flow, the lava flows. They would break up the lava, and then elk do what elk do. They fertilized. And all of a sudden, you started getting more plant life, more animal life. Folks, it's back. It didn't take thousands and thousands of years. Those of you who remember when Mount St. Helens actually erupted, it looked like a bomb went off. It covered everything. In fact, some of you may actually have a little vial of ash from Mount St. Helens. It blew ash 4 states away. Now, as you're thinking about that, there were people right around that mountain who were told to evacuate. One guy specifically, he owned a general store. He said, nope, I ain't going nowhere. My daddy had this store. Nothing happened to him. I have this store today. I ain't leaving. And he didn't. And he's not with us today. That's what happened. I mean, it literally looked like a bomb went off. Now, think with me for just a minute. You got a blank slate to test evolution. Because there's no life. There's no plants, no animals. So surely we're going to evolve new plants and animals, right? Everything that's there today, we'd already recorded in the past. And yet, here's the ironic thing. Everything I'm showing you on the screen, you can take your children, you can show them in person in about 2 days, but they'll never see it in their textbooks. Because you remember that geologic column? Folks, that geologic column automatically builds in hundreds of millions of years that your children need in order for evolution to get off the ground. You show them this stuff right here, and all of a sudden they realize, hey, wait a second, things aren't really that old. What's the one thing this theory's got to have lots and lots of time with? Or lots of? The answer? Time, right? In fact, let me share with you very quickly. This is a teacher's edition. Notice what I highlighted. It says, stress that the earth is thought to be at least 4.5 billion years old. Why would we stress that? Because without that much time, this theory is not getting off the ground. Now you look at me and you say, all right, Brad. So you're going to stand up here and tell us, you know, the earth's not all that old. What about dinosaurs? You're going to tell us that, like, dinosaurs weren't around millions of years? I mean, how do you harmonize dinosaurs with this creation thing? Are you going to tell us there's dinosaurs on the ark? To find out, you got to come back in about 10 minutes.